Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, Anne Ball brings us this week's science report. She tells us about a new study's suggestion for fighting climate change, planting 1 trillion new trees. Alice Bryant and Brian Lynn also have a report about trees. They tell us about a major environmental group's recent purchase of a part of America's Appalachian Forest. We end our program with the next episode of our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anne Ball.
Scientists are asking, what is the best way to fight climate change? A new study says, plant many trees. 1 trillion trees, maybe more. Swiss scientists say there is enough room for that many trees. In their report in the journal Science, they say even with existing cities and farmland, there is enough space for new trees to cover 9 million square kilometers. That is about the size of the United States. Trees take carbon dioxide out of the air and in return put oxygen back into the air. The study estimated that over a long period of time, the trees could take in almost 750 billion tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That is about as much carbon as humans have put into the atmosphere in the past 25 years. What is so bad about carbon dioxide? The gas traps heat, causing temperatures to rise. Much of the gain from planting trees will come quickly because trees remove more carbon from the air when they are younger, the researchers said. The place that has the best possibility for removing the most carbon is the tropics, the area close to the equator. This method would also have the lowest cost, says the study co-author Thomas Crowther. This is by far, by thousands of times, the cheapest climate change solution and the most effective, he said. Crowther is a climate change ecologist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. The 6 nations with the most room for new trees are Russia, the United States, Canada, Australia, Brazil, and China. Before his study, Crowther thought that there were other, more effective ways to fight climate change besides cutting emissions. One example could be for people to change their diets by no longer eating meat. But he said tree planting is far more effective because trees remove so much carbon dioxide from the air. Thomas Lovejoy works as a biologist at George Mason University. He was not part of the study, but he called the report a good news story because planting trees would also help stop the loss of biodiversity. Crowther said, planting trees is not a substitute for reducing the world's dependence on oil, coal, and natural gas. The carbon dioxide produced by burning these fuels is believed to cause the warming of the atmosphere. None of this works without emissions cuts, he said. And it is not easy or realistic to think the world will suddenly start planting a lot of trees quickly, although many groups have started, Crowther said. It's certainly a monumental challenge, which is exactly the scale of the problem of climate change, he said. The researchers used Google Earth to see what areas could support more trees, while leaving room for people and crops. Lead writer for the study, Jean-François Bastine, estimated there is space for at least 1 trillion more trees, but it could be 1.5 trillion. That is in addition to the 3 trillion trees that now live on Earth, a number Crowther found in earlier research. I'm Ann Ball.
One of the largest environmental groups in the United States recently purchased a part of the Appalachian Forest. The Nature Conservancy bought more than 40,000 hectares, an area covering parts of 3 states, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia. In their efforts to combat climate change, environmentalists see forests as one of the Earth's best defenses. Forests capture carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas. Yet the Nature Conservancy does not plan to close the land to logging. Increasingly, conservation groups are supporting the idea of human activity and wildlife protection existing together. They are beginning to reject the idea that conservation and economic growth are opposites. And larger conservation projects are now possible thanks to the western state of California. The state's rules on carbon are providing money for such projects.
The Nature Conservancy's recent purchase is a big one. It is of a size never before attempted in the central Appalachians, says Terry Cook. He is Tennessee State Director for the environmental group. These days in conservation, big projects are the goal. Scientists now know that protecting small, separate parts of nature are not as effective as working across large areas. What happens in the mountains affects nearby valleys. Highland forests capture, clean, and store water for ecosystems and communities below. Animals also need connecting areas of land to pass through, especially as climate change damages their old habitats. In addition, more trees have the ability to absorb or take in more carbon dioxide. But nearly everywhere on Earth, people are part of the countryside. Their needs cannot be ignored, notes Stuart Hale. He is the Nature Conservancy's Central Appalachian Forest Manager. The logging industry supports more than 100,000 jobs in Tennessee and 60,000 others in Kentucky. Hale told VOA that includes the loggers and truck drivers carrying the logs, workers at timber factories, and even those working at small stores.
It's a major part of the economy.
That is why, when the Conservancy bought the land, the group did not turn it into a nature preserve, Cook added. Spencer Meyer is the lead conservationist at the Heisted Foundation, an environmental group in the New England area. He said the Nature Conservancy's decision not to create a nature preserve was a good idea. Meyer said such projects need strong support from local communities, or they have a good chance of failing.
You know, hungry people make lousy conservationists.
Only part of the land will be logged. The Forest Stewardship Council, a nonprofit group, will make sure the logging operations meet environmental and safety measures. And cutting down trees is only one way the forest can make money. Thanks to California's climate change rules, forest owners can profit from their trees' carbon-absorbing powers. California industries must pay for each ton of carbon dioxide they produce or buy credits to decrease carbon in other areas. A piece of forest this large is worth millions of tons in carbon credits. Cook said that around $15 per ton on California's carbon market means tens of millions of dollars to buy land and keep it healthy for 100 years. Part of the money for the purchase comes from investors who will earn money from selling timber and future carbon credits. Hale noted that both the timber and the credits earn higher profits when the forest is healthy. The carbon credits, attention to community needs, and size of the land purchase are not very unusual. But this is probably the first time we've seen all of those pieces come together at this size, said Meyer. He expects the project to show proof of what he found in his research, that protecting nature does not have to mean losing jobs.
At least in New England, we're seeing a small but important signal that conservation leads to job growth.
That's good news for those hoping that preserving forests can help fight climate change without harming the economy. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
The presidential race looks jar-lid tight. We could be in for a long night as voters decide whether Vice President Al Gore or Texas Governor George Bush will be the next president of the United States. It is that close.
In 2000, Americans were preparing to elect a new president in November. The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Bill Clinton would be leaving office, so his Democratic Party needed to choose a new candidate. The Democrats nominated Clinton's vice president, Al Gore. Gore chose Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut as his running mate. Lieberman became the first Jewish candidate ever nominated by a major party to such a high office. He was first elected to the Senate in 1988. Al Gore was born in Washington in 1948. He was named after his father, a United States Senator from Tennessee. The future vice president grew up in Washington and in Carthage, Tennessee, where his family had a farm. He studied government at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and graduated in 1969. That was during the Vietnam War. His father opposed American involvement in that war. But the young Al Gore joined the Army and spent about 6 months of his service as a military journalist in Vietnam. Back in civilian life, Gore again worked as a reporter. Later, he studied religion and then law at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. But he dropped out of law school to enter politics. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1976. He became known for supporting nuclear arms control and protecting the environment. Al Gore was elected to the Senate in 1984. He was re-elected 6 years later. That was after he had tried to become the Democratic candidate for president in 1988. Then, in 1992, Bill Clinton won the party's nomination and asked Al Gore to be his vice president. As vice president, Gore became known for his work on issues involving the environment, technology, and foreign relations. In March 1999, he gave an interview on CNN. During that interview, he talked about his plans to enter the race for the presidential nomination the following year. He made the statement that during his service in Congress,
I took the initiative in creating the internet.
He went on to say that he took the initiative in moving forward other efforts important to the economy, environmental protection, and educational improvements. But his comment about the internet led to jokes and criticism that he was claiming to have actually invented it. The Republicans nominated Texas Governor George W. Bush as their presidential candidate. For his running mate, he chose Dick Cheney, a former Secretary of Defense. George Walker Bush was born in Texas in 1946, the oldest child of former President George Herbert Walker Bush. He grew up in the Texas cities of Midland and Houston. He graduated from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, and earned a master's in business administration at Harvard University. During the Vietnam War years, he was a pilot in the Texas Air National Guard. Later, he worked in the state's oil and gas industry. In 1988, Bush worked on his father's winning campaign for president. Later, he became one of the owners of the Texas Rangers, a Major League Baseball team. In 1994, George W. Bush was elected governor of Texas. He was re-elected 4 years later. Several other candidates also ran for president in the November 2000 election. These minor, or so-called third-party candidates, included activist Ralph Nader. He represented the Green Party. He criticized large corporations for having too much influence in America. Pat Buchanan, a conservative, ran as the Reform Party candidate. Public opinion surveys showed that the race between George Bush and Al Gore would be extremely close. The election took place on November 7th. More than 100 million people voted for them. Al Gore received about 540,000 more of those votes than George Bush did. But winning the popular vote does not make someone president. Americans do not directly elect their president. When they vote for a candidate, what they are really doing is voting for electors. The number of electors for each state is based on the size of its congressional delegation, which is based on population. These electors then vote in December in a system known as the Electoral College. The Electoral College officially elects the president. In the 2000 election, there were 538 electors in the Electoral College. To become president, the winner needed a simple majority of 270. Al Gore won the popular vote, but neither he nor George Bush won a majority of the electoral votes. Not that any of this was clear on election night.
Bulletin, Florida pulled back into the undecided column. This thing is so wild, wacky, and woolly, nobody knows how it's going
to
come out.
CNN right now is moving Florida to the too close to call column.
Too close to call.
Florida is now too close to call. I want to say that again. It's a confusing situation. Now, if you're disgusted with us, frankly, I don't blame you.
Florida is a big southern state. It had enough electoral votes to make either candidate the winner. Election officials counted almost 6 million votes on election night. George Bush had slightly more votes than Al Gore, but not enough to avoid a recount. Florida state law calls for a recount when the difference between two candidates is less than 0.5% of the votes. State recounts normally involve the governor, but the governor of Florida said he would not get involved. That was because the governor was Jeb Bush, George Bush's brother, and there were other issues with the election. Some black voters said election workers had unjustly prevented them from voting. There were also problems with voting machines and ballots. In one area, some Gore supporters believed they had voted for Pat Buchanan by mistake. The names were next to one another on the ballot. Democrats said the ballot design was illegal. Republicans said Democratic Party officials had never objected to it. The disputed election results in Florida introduced a new term into popular speech. Americans began talking about chads. Whether it was hanging chads, pregnant chads, or dimpled chads, it amounted to the same problem. It meant that a voting machine had not cleanly punched out a bit of paper called a chant when the voter made a choice. As a result, the ballot would confuse a vote counting machine and make the choice unreadable. That, in turn, meant election workers had to look at each questionable ballot and try to decide the voter's choice. All this took place with the nation and the world watching and wondering who would become America's next president. Something else only added to anger and debate over the situation in Florida. Florida's Secretary of State, its chief election officer, Catherine Harris, also happened to be a leader of the Bush campaign there.
Governor George W. Bush, 2,912,790.
Almost 3 weeks after the election, Florida officials declared George Bush the winner of the state's 25 electoral votes. That gave him a total of 271. Out of 6 million ballots, state officials said he had defeated Al Gore by 537 votes. But the election was still not over. Gore and his supporters in Florida asked the courts to reject the results because of what they said were the many voting problems. The Florida Supreme Court ordered another count of the disputed ballots. Bush campaign officials quickly appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The court said Florida law did not explain how officials should judge the ballots. The court found the situation in Florida unconstitutional because there were different standards around the state. The justices also said not enough time remained to settle the issue before the Electoral College had to meet. On December 12th, the court voted 7-2 to end the recount and 5-4 against ordering a new one. 6 days later, on December 18th, members of the Electoral College met in each state capital and the District of Columbia. They made the election official. George W. Bush would become the 43rd President of the United States.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
He took office on January 20th, 2001. The election dispute had divided Americans. But less than a year later, the nation was brought together by events that would set the direction for the presidency of George W. Bush.
A plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. It happened just a few moments ago.
The United States suffered the worst terrorist attacks in its history on September 11th, 2001, a day that would be remembered as 9/11.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow, same time, same place. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Thompson.